Meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. It is 1:19 p.m. Today is Friday, May 3rd, 2019. Members present are Representative Tuck, Representative Hannon, Representative Sponholz, Vice Chair Hopkins, Co-Chair Tarr, and myself, Representative Lincoln. Please let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business, and before we start, I'd like to remind everyone to silence their cell phones. Assisting us today is our Recording Secretary, Ms. Debbie Tillinghast, and our LIO moderator, Doug Bridges. We're starting late, obviously, due to the floor session going late, and I just want to let everyone know that we're planning to take a brief at ease at around 2 p.m. so that we can participate in a presentation in room 106 just down the hall on missing and murdered Indigenous women. So just want to give people a heads up about that. The first order of business is Senate Bill 43, extending the termination date for the Big Game Commercial Services Board. This is the second hearing on SB 43. It was introduced to committee last Wednesday, where we heard invited in public testimony and heard an overview of the board's sunset review audit by DCCED. The committee has not received any amendments for this bill, and it is the intention of the co-chairs to take final action on the bill today. Senator Wilson, please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and provide any closing comments you might have.
Thank you, Chair Lincoln and Co-Chair Tarr, for hearing the Senate Bill 43, extending the termination of Big Game Services Board. At this time, Mr. Chair, I just want to remind folks that this board does provide a valuable service to the community and to the state of Alaska, and we appreciate the time again and the resources for hearing this board. And in conclusion, this board just plays an important role in managing the activities of the commercial game hunters in the interests of the state wildlife resources. And I just thank you guys for again hearing this bill.
Thank you. And Rep. Talarico has joined us. Are there any questions from the committee for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, I'd entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to report committee substitute for Senate Bill 43, labeled 31-LS0442/M, with individual recommendation and attached fiscal notes, out of committee.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chairs. Are there any objections?
Just a recess.
In a brief at ease? At ease. Okay, we are back on record. Is there any objection to Senate Bill 43? Seeing none, the bill moves from committee. Thank you very much, Senator Wilson. Please let the record reflect also that Representative Rauscher has joined us. The next item on the agenda is brief eddies. So the next order of business is House Bill 138 relating to designation of outstanding national resource waters. This is the second hearing on the bill since it was introduced to committee last Wednesday, where we heard invited in public testimony. The co-chairs do not intend to move the bill out of committee today. The first order of business on this would be to actually close public testimony because the committee neglected to do that at the end of the last meeting. So public testimony is now closed on 138. The committee members also posed several questions on the bill, including how other states designate Tier 3 waters and its impacts to local municipalities, also whether the DEC currently has the authority to designate Tier 3 waters and how other states designate Tier 3 waters. Please see the legal memo regarding designating a Tier 3 water body by ballot measure, as well as a memo from DEC on how other states designate Tier 3 waters and a memo regarding the statutory authority of DEC to designate Tier 3 waters that already exists. Does the sponsor of the bill, Representative Kopp, have anything to add at this time? Or?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, for the record, Chuck Kopp, Representative District 24. Thank you. Yes, the memos that you just cited should help answer some of the questions the committee had, and I would just leave those for the committee's review. Thank you.
Okay. Since you've been brief, Eddie's. Also on the line is Jennifer Curie. Are you there, Ms. Curie?
I am.
This would be a good time to introduce the legal memos that we described earlier. Is that something you're prepared to do right now?
Co-Chair Lincoln, I don't believe those are my memos, and so it might be more appropriate for Ledge Legal to introduce those.
Co-Chair Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, Ms. Curie, what we were hoping, because we have these legislative legals from these memos from our legislative legal folks, to go over these same two things with you as the Department of Law representative, because from our first hearing, there are some basic points of fact where there's disagreement, and so we want to kind of like try and ground truth it. And so if you could help us, number one issue was whether a designation could take place through a citizen initiative, and our legislative legal department says no because of the common property resource allocation issue. And then number two is on the point of the statutory authority as it currently exists, and according to our legislative legal department, that DEC currently has the authority to do the designation. So if we could talk through those two issues and get your response from Department of Law or the administration's position on those two matters, that is what we hope to have in this conversation.
Co-Chair Tarr, absolutely. I think, so the first issue is whether the legislation as written prohibits an initiative from being filed with respect to designation of Tier 3 waters. And I would say that legislation doesn't have the ability to cut off the right to file an initiative. And so the Department of Law plays an integral role in deciding whether or not an initiative is an appropriation. And at this point, we're not in a position to adjudicate a hypothetical situation where Tier 3 might be brought forward through initiative, but I wouldn't say that it cuts off the opportunity.
Could I follow up? And thank you, Ms. Curie. I just want to read from the legislative legal memo that we have, and it says, you asked whether if HB 138 passed, the law would preclude designation of outstanding national resource water by initiative. The short answer is, under the recent Alaska Supreme Court ruling holding in Malott versus Stand for Salmon, an initiative probably could not be used to designate outstanding national resource water without violating constitutional provisions, regardless of whether HB 138 passes. So are you saying the Department of Law's position is that that is incorrect?
I would say that the Department of Law's position is that whether or not it was an appropriation would depend on the facts of the initiative itself, and we're not prepared to offer an opinion about whether every Tier 3 water designation brought by initiative would be an appropriation.
If I may also, but one of the main underlying points is that you set aside the question of whether a Tier 3 water body can be designated by ballot initiative or not. That's part of our Constitution, the common use cause, but setting that question aside, any sort of statutory change wouldn't have an impact on the ability for citizen-led initiatives to take place. Is that
correct? I believe that's correct, yeah.
Okay. Are there any questions from the committee on the first topic of ballot initiatives and the legal memos? Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, and I missed her name.
Ms. Curie,
you said you were unclear as to whether all ballot initiatives that would do that would do Tier 3 designation would be found unconstitutional. Could you expand on that and tell me the circumstances that you think why some would and why some wouldn't?
Representative Hannon, through the chair, I believe that the individual circumstances of a Tier 3 designation would or could affect whether or not the Department of Law would determine that it was an appropriation or not. And so I think that we can't wholeheartedly say, as alleged legal has, that it's likely that every initiative brought to designate a Tier 3 would be an appropriation.
Follow.
Thank you, and through the chair. So that's the point I'm confused by. So could you give me an example of one that you think, and make it a hypothetical of why one would, how one designation could be an appropriation and another one wouldn't be an appropriation? Because legally, I don't understand that.
Representative Hannon, through the chair, I'm hesitant to do that because we have a distinct role in determining whether or not an initiative is an appropriation or not, and I wouldn't want to opine about that without something concrete being proposed.
I guess my follow-up, and would it depend on the size of the river, the acreage impacted, the number of people affected? What would be the factors that would determine whether it's an appropriation or not? Because that's, not being a lawyer, I don't understand the threading of the needle. And so just what would be the circumstance, without even a specific, what would be the things that would weigh in? I mean, in my mind, an appropriation of the cost, or is it the amount of the legal taking, or is it the number of people involved, or it is the acreage involved, or is it, I'm not sure what the legal factors would be.
Representative Hannon, through the chair, I think that all of the things that you brought up could be factors. I also think that things like technology and geography and many other things could come into the equation.
Okay. Thank you.
Rep. Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is very confusing, and what we're hoping to do here is, right, to kind of work through these details, because in the legal memo we have, I just want to read another statement from it and get your reaction. This says, in the context of the standard being used, it says the department has described the standard, quote, if a water were to be designated by a state as a Tier 3 water, comma, new or increased discharges that would lower or degrade the existing water quality would not be allowable unless they were temporary or limited, end quote. Then it goes on to say, because this standard would likely completely prevent the legislature from permitting projects that result in the permanent destruction of outstanding natural resource water, a court is likely to find that an initiative nominating outstanding natural resource water constitutes an unconstitutional appropriation.
Representative Tarr, I guess I disagree with that. I disagree that there is a way to categorically say that without having a specific river to consider.
Darn it. That's all I can say. but thank you. That's just really interesting. Pardon me, through the chair, that we have these two sort of conflicting thoughts on this and trying to sort of weave through it. For me, I'm just concerned that there's always a opportunity for citizen participation should whichever route we choose otherwise limit that, or that's kind of my interest. And so this is just a challenge because they're saying that at least through this process that wouldn't be a way for the citizens to participate, but you're saying kind of it depends. And I wonder, could you, if you looked at the five nominations that exist right now, do you think you would be able to evaluate those based on the existing nominations?
Representative Tarr, I think, quite frankly, that it would be inappropriate for the Department of Law to opine on an on the rivers that have been proposed when they haven't been proposed by initiative. Because if they were to come by initiative and we were to have already offered an opinion, that would be prejudicial.
Yep, yep, that makes sense. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Any other questions on this memo or this topic? Thank you, Ms. Curie. Is there another memo that you'd like to?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then I think, and I'm just looking at my staff to get confirmation that everybody has the second memo as well. And so the second memo is about whether without a piece of legislation that the department already has the ability to do the nominations. And I believe that memo says that, yes, they actually can do these. Do you want to take a brief of these?
I want to know who the memo is from. And
Ledge Legal. So both of ours, you know, we request through Ledge Legal, and then Department of Law, of course, represents the administration. So, again, we're trying to get some basic foundation on the facts here. Unsuccessful so far, but we'll try here for number two. So
that's the May 2nd memo?
Well, we'll take a brief of these so members can get the memo. Okay, all members of the committee have the memo in question in front of them now from May 2nd on the topic of whether DEC currently has statutory authority to designate outstanding national resource water bodies or Tier 3 waters. The opinion from Ledge Legal is that, quote, ultimately they believe it is likely a court would find that the department has the statutory authority to designate or manage a water as an outstanding national resource water. Ms. Curie, are you still there?
I am.
Have you had a chance to review this memo?
Representative Lincoln, I had looked at all the documents about 2 hours ago, and it wasn't on there, so I have briefly looked at it, but haven't had a time to go into it in depth.
Okay. I believe Ms. Representative Hannon has a question for Mr. Kraps at DEC. Are you there, Mr. Kraps?
Yes, I am.
Rep. Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Kraps, we asked what other states used. I'm looking at your memo dated May 3rd, response number 2 in the very bottom line. It says there are 4 states, Idaho, Indiana, Maine, and Montana, where the designation lies with the legislature. Can you tell me whether those 4 states, any of the 4, is it exclusively a legislative designation, or is there a process that legislature in those states must use to make that determination?
Through the chair, for those 4 states, no, they are not exclusive. There is a process before legislative approval.
And could you expand on that or send us the research? Because I assume it's probably not the same in each of the 4. Or describe what those 4 states' process is prior to a legislative designation?
Yes, through the chair, I can briefly describe those, and if you need follow-up information, we should be able to provide that as well. For the most part, in general, there is either an agency, a board, or a commission review before those nominations are then forwarded to the legislature for final approval.
Mr. Kraps, through the chair, do you have an understanding that the legislature then is looking at a scored and evaluation done by an agency, board, or commission that the legislature is taking an action on? And so let me just use a scale of 0 to 100, and you need a cut score of 75 to pursue the designation, but if your score was only 25, you don't pursue a designation? Or does the legislature have total latitude, irregardless of what the agency, board, or commission's recommendation is?
Through the chair, is my understanding that it would be the latter, that the legislature has the latitude regardless of what is provided to them.
Through Through the chair. And do you have any knowledge as to what the consistency of complying with the recommendations given to those legislatures has been in those states? So if their water board recommends to them that this designation be made, that they take it all the time, some of the time, or never the or is it more widely varied?
Through the chair, it would be widely varied. For example, Idaho is one of the states we identified, and they have not designated a Tier 3 water yet.
Thank you. Through the chair, so I guess my final is, how long have they had a process that allow or has the legislature be the determination? So if they've never done it, but is it a year old or is it 40 years old?
Through the chair, again, that would vary by state, and I would have to provide that information at a later date.
Okay, thank you.
Coach Yatar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Curie, I want to just go back to you on that second legislative memo, legal memo, just to get a reaction to that concept. from the administration's perspective, I guess there's conflicting information on this, too, as to whether DEC can currently do this and whether the legislation is necessary. And I just wonder, does the administration have a position on that?
Representative Tarr, I'm afraid I'm not going to make it easy for you at all on this either. It's the department's position that it's not as clear-cut as conclusion as the memo would present that you have in front of you, and the reason for that is that the designation of a Tier 3 water contains many other factors besides water quality and purity, which is what DEC was delegated authority to make decisions on, and because of that, we think that it is an unclear issue as to whether DEC currently has the authority to do those designations.
So okay. I think, and perhaps the conversation will be a little bit more productive once everyone's had more time to deal with them. And, you know, we're less than a couple of weeks at the end of session here, and we'll be taking up this legislation probably in the interim, learning more about it, taking action one way or another probably next session. So at this time, we'll try to make good use of our time now and turn to the presentation from AML that was prepared in response to some questions from committee at the first hearing, and may or may not pick it up after our break here in 10-15 minutes.
And Mr. Chairman, Ms. Curie, before you go, as we're transitioning and getting the presentation set up, does the department have a position on having a dual, I guess, process? Because previously, as the bill was originally introduced, and I think the administration was supporting it in the other body, it was, you know, had to be reviewed by three departments and then also go to the legislature for approval. So it was sort of still it was a more tenuous but single pathway, if you will. But there could be an opportunity, as we're talking about, for perhaps, you know, agency designation or legislative approval, so that you sort of, you know, if people feel like the agency is being non-responsive, any constituent could go to their legislator. They would have, that would be, in my mind, a citizen pathway, which is something I'm interested in, but it could be sort of a dual process. Do you have any thoughts, or is there a position on that idea?
Representative Tarr, I would have to see the wording of any amendment, but I don't have an opinion on that one way or the other.
And again, we'll continue this conversation at a later date and turn to the presentation from AML now. Thank you, Ms. Curie, for your participation today, and we'll look forward to a continued conversation in the interim and next session. Mr. Andreessen.
Right. For the record, my name is Nils Andreessen. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League. Thank you for the time today, and I realize that it's short, so I'll try to go quickly and be responsive. This is a follow-up to my testimony on Monday, which I, again, appreciated the opportunity for. I think I was asked on Monday to talk a little bit about the role of or the municipal impact related to Tier 3 designation. And I just wanted to say as a starting point, and almost similar to Department of Law, maybe I've always wanted to use the phrase adjudicate hypotheticals. This is a tough position to be in because in a lot of ways that's what is being asked of AML, is to determine, you know, what that impact looks like for a community without that community and that question in front of us. So I'm going to do my best to walk through what hypotheticals look like and at least run through what I know or understand related to this bill. And to be clear, the bill, as I understand it, is to determine whether the legislature is the appropriate body to make decisions related to Tier 3 designations. And separately and differently, it's not about whether an actual Tier 3 designation has impact or value or what those would be. So that's my starting point in approaching this, and I will do my best to answer your questions along the way. I'm basing a lot of my understanding on the work that DEC has done. And this is just a snapshot of a number of documents that I've seen from DEC related to Tier 3 designation. And the starting point is that newer increased discharges that would lower or degrade the existing water quality would not be allowable. And that impacts communities in a lot of different ways and across the board, across the state.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. So I think it's pretty well known that the legislature has the ultimate decision-making authority to use specific public assets for specific purposes. So is that what we're reviewing today, is that we do have that authority?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, that's my understanding of the bill's intent. I think what was asked of me is the municipal impact or the relationship between municipalities, local governments, and this bill.
Okay. All right. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. There was a question at the first hearing on the impacts to municipalities for different types of projects, and Andreessen agreed to follow up with the committee on to answer some of those questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just looking at that first bullet point. The question raised by House Bill 130 is whether the legislature is best suited to determine impact. I think we have the ultimate decision just naturally and just by our Constitution. So I didn't know if we were going to go over that issue as much, but if it's the impact on the municipalities, then forgive me. Oh.
Thank you, Representative. Talk through the chair. I'll continue. And you have the DEC analysis in front of you, so I won't read through this, but I wanted to at least reference it. The roles of municipalities are many, and so we went through the 165 cities and boroughs that are members of AML that are incorporated as cities or boroughs or as political subdivisions of the state, and looked at their intersection with water. And 112 municipalities have the power to manage their water systems. 111 have the power to manage and have responsibility for sewer and wastewater. 72 municipalities have adopted the power to manage their ports and harbors. 109 municipalities have adopted the power to manage their landfills, solid and hazardous waste. 108 municipalities have adopted powers related to road construction and maintenance, and further two municipalities have adopted powers related to flood control. Each of these intersect with a Tier 3 designation. And it's not across the board in terms of how municipalities have adopted powers. So out of all of these, only 12 local governments have no powers related to any of these. So roughly 7% aren't responsible in a way that intersects with the Tier 3 designation. 93% of city and borough governments in the state would potentially be affected by Tier 3 designation. Potentially, hypothetically, given that we don't have a Tier 3 designation in front of us. I would additionally note that our understanding is that things like fish waste or processing facilities within those communities that communities might depend on as a tax base could be impacted. Gravel pits that are necessary for local infrastructure, road construction, building materials might be impacted. And further, there are questions around barge traffic or fuel delivery, and to the extent that they're not temporary impacts, those might be considered. So all of those.
Thank you. Through the chair. Mr. Andreessen, did you happen to look at the five current nominations for Rivers? And could you tell me how many municipalities or organized governments that intersects with?
Yes, Representative Hannon, through the chair. If I can come to that, I do have a slide that will address it. So that was our starting point to review those 165 cities and boroughs. Additionally, it was interesting to look at the Village Safe Water Program, which addresses beyond incorporated cities, other communities that might have water, wastewater needs. And this isn't very readable, but really it's just as an example. So we've these were priority projects listed within the Village Safe Water Program. And you'll see that there are a number of communities over the next three slides that are waiting on first service, which would be new service, which could potentially add to discharge related to water bodies, or upgrades to service, which again could potentially add to discharges related to water bodies. So it's incredibly significant, not just for incorporated cities and boroughs, but for communities around the state, and including for those that are still waiting for water and wastewater management. And again, this is probably something better for DEC to follow up on in the future as you further consider this.
Rep. Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair. Could you verify? So first service on your chart going through communities means they currently have no municipal or local government water service whatsoever. Individual homeowners would be using honey buckets or have septics or have wells of their own, but there's no municipal water system. That's what first service means.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, that's my understanding. It might be less that there's no municipal service, or there's no service in that community, or that there's an expansion of service in the community different than an upgrade to those facilities, and DEC might be able to answer that better, but that's my understanding. I'll continue, Chair. Representative Hannon, you asked about current nominations. I don't have these nominations in front of me. I think that these are the communities near to or related to the water bodies that have been nominated, and I'm just using these as an illustration of the different type of communities related to what might be nominated. So I don't have a clear picture of the Chandelier. These were nearby communities. You have one that's organized. It's incorporated, but in the unorganized borough. It has some responsibilities. You have two communities that are unincorporated, so don't have those powers, and are in the unorganized borough. You have Yakutat, which, as a city and borough, has a full suite of responsibilities, and also an ordinance objecting to the nomination. You have the Chilkat, and a difference between the Haynesboro, which again is incorporated, and Klukwan, which is unincorporated and in the unorganized borough. So different types of responsibilities, even related to any one water body, different powers, different obligations. In the Kaktuli River, similar scenario where you have different communities with different responsibilities. And I think especially when it comes to unincorporated communities in the unorganized borough, it does place the question of a Tier 3 designation back on this body as that borough's assembly, and I'll speak to that. So, Representative Tuck, you talked a little bit about the authority that you do have, and so the justification for legislative approval found related to HB 138, it starts for us in the Constitution. To be clear, the members that I have talked with have said that they would prefer that power, that it should be or could be a local decision. I think the review of the communities just related to the nominations that have occurred so far make that challenging. But certainly our approach, AML's approach, is that this body gives those communities, these stakeholders, an opportunity to air the challenges, concerns, questions they have in front of policymakers responsible for making those decisions. I mentioned the unorganized borough, and it's interesting, and DEC maybe can follow up at some other point to talk about that the majority of APTE's permits, and I don't know what that means, are issued within an organized borough. So you've got really, you've got the capabilities, capacity, you have DEC as a regulator in those areas in a way that you might not have in the unorganized borough. And the fact that the unorganized borough doesn't have an assembly other than the legislature gives you maybe a different obligation than in an organized borough. There's extensive impact to local governments across the state, but again, not all of these are regulated by DEC, and the legislature is in a strong position to work with DEC to fully vet, with public input, any proposal designating a water of national significance. And when I think of that term, a body or a water of national significance, it speaks to me that that goes beyond an agency decision, that similar to the congressional U.S. Congress's role in naming national parks and other conservation units, that's a decision that is political. It can be best made with best science and public input, but is appropriately made here.
Co-Chair Tarr has a question.
Yeah.
Well, and I was just going to comment because it's actually a key point of why this is so problematic. APDES is Alaska Pollution Discharge Elimination System, and the state of Alaska has primacy under the Clean Water Act for that responsibility, which is a whole part of this conversation in terms of delegation of authority and who gets to do that. So I just wanted to comment on that.
Thank you. Finally, speaking to the role of the legislature, the legislature has been active in creating and naming conservation units in the state, created the state park system, has nominated and designated 120 park units, created 13 marine parks, most recently created a park in 2008. You've been active in designation of conservation units, and I don't know that that should be different when it comes to waters of national significance. I was pleased to be part of the invited testimony on Monday, and it was great to see the amount of public testimony that this body brought to the fore, that in the consideration of a waters of national significance, this body was able to bring people up and out to talk about what that meant to them. So we're glad to be part of this process, and when we move beyond hypotheticals to a designation, we'll be at this table, hopefully talking about exactly what it would look like for each and every community. Thank you.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question, and that is for whoever can answer this one. But once the legislature determines a Tier 3 designation, can future legislatures reverse that decision, or is that into perpetuity once the designation is made?
Mr. Kraps, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Did you hear the question from Representative Tuck?
Yes.
Are you able to?
sure. The Clean Water Act is not, doesn't detail that. In discussions with EPA, their opinion is that there's no precedent for that. So the possibility for a Tier 3 designation to be undesignated is available, and it would be on a case-by-case basis.
Thank you very much.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. My question is for Mr. Andreessen and the Alaska Municipal League. And I'm curious, because this issue's been around for a while, whether the Municipal League has taken a stance on whether impacted communities should have a formal stop in the process, because as the bill is currently written, it would be up to the legislature, 60 people exclusively, to make that decision. Does the Municipal League feel like communities should have any say in the process as a formal checkoff, involvement, engagement, consultation or just engage in the political process. So if you're a community that has power, you might have a say, but if you're a small isolated community that's unincorporated, there is no say, or have they weighed in on that element of it?
Yeah, Representative Hannon, through the chair. I think that's a good question. Certainly something that we'd be happy to weigh in on at the appropriate point in your further consideration of this bill. We haven't tackled it specifically. I think in my thinking through our approach currently, it really started with that the legislative process beyond that end decision point by those 60 legislators has built into it a committee structure that I think is relevant and meaningful and produces a lot of that stakeholder engagement that makes things accessible and hopefully produces outcomes consistent with the public interest.
We'll follow up, because you offered when you went through the 5998 Rivers and you mentioned that in Yakutat the community had issued a resolution in opposition to the Yakutat Four Lands, but I'm curious as to whether any of the other communities have offered input into any of those other nominations. Like, I believe Klekwan, which is unorganized, has weighed in that they're in support of a designation, but.
Right. Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I believe that others similarly have weighed in, but again, I think without having that in front of us, it's hard for me to say or to poll members for that feedback. It would be, we could check with Haynesboro probably to see what they've said, but it would be on a case-by-case basis. I would certainly appreciate a weighted consideration when it comes to municipal government, and I think that would be valuable.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Co-Chair Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When we passed the enabling statutes after the citizen initiative legalizing marijuana, we gave the sort of local option component of it. I don't know if that same kind of model could be used here, but you know, you were just saying sort of like weighted participation for municipalities. Could you see something like that kind of idea where there's some other local component either has to sort of like weigh in support or something for consideration, or how could that be accomplished, I guess, is my question.
Sure. Through the chair, co-chair Dar, I think something, an elegant solution like that would be something that we would definitely want to work with you to achieve and make sure that we ensure that local control and especially local voice in establishing or designating a water of national significance. Mm-hmm. So that's certainly something that we would consider.
Any other questions for Mr. Andreessen? Thank you for the follow-up. So we will, I don't know how much.
One other question, I'm sorry.
Co-Chair Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For Mr. Kraps at DEC, I'm sorry, when you said there's no precedent for undesignating, and that you were talking about the EPA's guidance on that, but if we do this where it's a situation where you designate by statute, I mean, anything, any statute can be repealed, so it would seem that there would be a process for that. And so I was just, I'm sorry if I misunderstood what you said, but I just wanted to clarify that.
Yes, to the chair. Yes, I was just speaking to the Clean Water Act, and it is not, you know, doesn't specify that. And so whatever the process, again, whatever the process the states arrive on, is what the Tier 3 process will be.
So just to clarify, the designation of a Tier 3, that's a federal designation that the federal government has asked states to come up with a process to nominate and designate. So even if we were to designate, you know, ask for a designation through statute, just because we rolled back the statute, it wouldn't automatically compel the federal government to roll the designation back. There's nothing in law right now that prevents that, but there's also nothing that specifies a procedure or explicitly authorizes them to do that. So, and I, situations or any sort of ambiguity in a topic that's got multiple positions on it's going to end up in court. So at this point, I mean, I think it's a basically a foregone conclusion that if the state were to have a designated Tier 3 and then try to roll it back, it would get, it'd have to go to court and get settled there. Does that help?
I'm so confused, but that's okay.
Okay. So, again, I think every member of the committee appreciates how important this bill is and the topic, and there's no intention of trying to rush this process, and this session will be learning more about it in the interim, potentially having hearings in the interim, and then try to address it in a very informed and responsible way next session, one way or another. I just want to make that clear to everybody. And I did want to spend a few minutes at the event just down the hall, so at this time we will take a brief at ease, 10 minutes, and come back at 2:25 sharp just to get into the next item on our agenda. Record, our last order of business today is House Bill 116 by Representative Story and Christ Tompkins. Would Rep Story and any staff you'd like to join you please come to the front, introduce yourselves, and begin your presentation on House Bill 116.
Thank you, Chairs Tarr and Lincoln. Representative Andy Story, District 34, and thank you, members of the House Resources Committee, for hearing House Bill 116, a bill that would simplify the Department of Natural Resources lease renewal process for aquatic farms that grow products such as oysters, kelp, and other shellfish. If enacted, House Bill 116 would help Alaska-based aquaculture businesses succeed by shortening the lease renewal process. Aquaculture is an industry with a lot of promise, and Alaska, with more coastline than all the other states combined, has a bountiful potential. The Alaska Mariculture Task Force set a goal of making this a $100 million industry in the next 20 years. As you can see from the flow chart in your bill packet, requirements to permit and operate an aquatic farm or related hatchery is complex. The most rigorous and time-consuming portion of the approval process is the DNR aquatic farming site lease, both the original lease and the subsequent renewal. Due to recent increases in the number of aquaculture farm applications, there was one application in 2016, 17 applications in 2017, and 16 in 2018, coupled with recent cuts to agency staff, it now takes an average of 18 months or more to approve an aquatic farm lease. By simplifying the renewal process, we can reduce risk for businesses making significant capital investments and reduce the workload on overstretched agency staff. House Bill 116 aligns the lease renewal process for aquatic farms to the process used for other DNR leases. This would significantly shorten the first renewal process while still allowing appropriate regulatory oversight, public engagement, and appeals of DNR's decisions. I would like to mention that this bill would not affect leases for salmon hatcheries. As a new legislature, I am pleased with how this bill began and how it was developed. Shortly after taking office, I was contacted by a constituent who is currently in the process of transferring an aquatic farm lease, a process that would not be affected by this bill. They shared their experiences with the lease transfer process and suggested a few possible changes that might help applicants. During subsequent conversations, DNR staff mentioned the streamlining of the aquatic farm renewal process as a way to reduce uncertainty for applicants and increase agency efficiency. Thank you for your time and for hearing this important legislation. I and my staff, Greg Smith, welcome any questions from the committee. And if the committee wishes, Mr. Smith could walk through the four proposed changes to statute included in this bill.
Okay, and also available are Marty Parsons from the Director of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, Alpheus Bullard, Ledge Legal, the drafter of the bill, and Mr. Pryor, are you Yeah, and Flip Pryor from Fish and Game to answer any questions. Are there any questions from the committee at this point? Representative Tuck?
Just real quick, when we talk about hatchery, we're talking about salmon hatchery. Is that correct? No? Okay. Because I noticed there was a title change from one version to another version where we took out, where we specifically put shellfish hatchery, not Sheffield hatchery. And okay, and it looked like that was basically the only change was the title on this. Okay.
Through the chair. Yes, we specifically changed the title because people were thinking we were referring to salmon, and we wanted to make it clear that we weren't, that that wouldn't be affected.
Okay, thank you. And another one? Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you walk us through just a little bit how the process works now?
Sure. I'm going to give that over to Mr. Smith.
Representative Tuck, through the chair. Greg Smith, staff to Representative Story. So for aquatic farms, when they seek a DNR lease to use public lands for a private purpose, for some reason that I have not discovered why in the legislative record, aquatic farm leases are under a separate section of statute. The most other uses or leases given by DNR are under 070, and it's actually a section just titled generally, and they call them general leases. Those would be things like, well, a variety of uses: cabins, lodges, fish processing plant docks, hydroelectric facilities, grazing. There's probably many, many other uses where, again, where the state grants a private entity rights to public land. Anyway, aquatic farms leasing is held separate, and when they first apply for a lease, they go through a pretty intense, there's an application, you can see the flow chart. When they go through the lease, there's a large public process, public comment process and notification that's found in 3805-945. When aquatic farms, they get up to a 10-year lease, at the end of that 10-year lease, or as it's getting close to the end of the 10-year lease, they can apply for a renewal. Currently, aquatic farms, upon renewal, have to go through this very lengthy public comment process. For some reason, when other leases under general leases go up for a renewal, the director may renew a lease under a shortened public comment process. In that case, they may be renewed if the lease is in good standing and it's determined to be in the best interest of the state. From our understanding from DNR, and in terms of the applicant or impacts on the applicant of this change, they would still be submitting similar information to the department, what they're expecting their impacts to be. Again, the benefit is that under the 945 notice, it takes about 18 months for them to issue a lease. Under the shortened, again, optional lease renewal, it will take about 90 days. And again, that 070 renewal is a shortened process. It's an optional process, and nearly all other lease types are, that is an option for them. And for some reason, again, we haven't found aquaculture farms are not, they're not able to, the director's not able to renew a lease under, for an aquaculture farm under that shortened process.
Follow up. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So it looks like from here, from the flow chart, and thanks for pointing out the flow chart. And those leases are good for 10 years, is that correct? Do we have any records or any information on those that have been denied?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, were you talking about original leases that have been denied or lease renewals?
Lease renewals.
Representative Tuck, through the chair, to the what I heard from the department is they've actually never denied an aquatic farm lease renewal, even well under the current process.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Like on that point, do you know approximately how many have been renewed? Like what's the scale of the...
Mr. Chairman, I actually don't know the total number of lease renewals. One of the impetus for this bill is that the number of lease applications has increased significantly in recent years, as Representative Story showed. Those will be coming up for renewal 10 years after the initial lease was started. So I would say probably now there are a handful of lease renewals happening every year, if that many. I think the concern is 10 years from now or in the current time, there will be 17, 18, 20 lease renewals coming
up. It's not too much of a hassle. I'd just like to, more out of curiosity, sure, as much as anything. Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question, because I don't know a lot about this issue. I know that there's a fair number of aquatic agriculture in South Central and Southeast. Is there any productivity or any development or potential for development outside of the along the rest of the coast of Alaska or on lakes or anything like that, or is it mostly going to be concentrated exclusively in South Central and Southeast?
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, good question. I do not know. Someone from Fish and Game may be able to speak more to that.
Mr. Pryor, are you there?
Yes, this is Flip Pryor, Alaska Department of Fish and Game. There is potential in other areas. I cannot tell you specifically where there's been concentrations of interest.
Thank you. That's all right.
Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, I was just wondering, with a typical lease permit situation, how much land is or isn't there a typical amount of land? I'm sure it varies, but I'm not sure how much. And is it a great deal? And if so, why?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, you were correct. It does vary significantly. We have some public testifiers on, and I believe, depending who is actually going to testify, I know it varies up to, I believe some of the larger ones are 150 acres. There may be larger, and I believe some of the leases are in the single digits of acres. So there is a great variety. DNR would be able to give you more specifics if you'd like.
Marty. Should we, what's up?
Let's ask Marty.
Mr. Parsons, are you available?
Good afternoon. Yes, this is Marty Parsons, the director of the Division of Mining, Land and Water here at Anchorage. Representative Rauscher through the chair. There is a wide variety down to single digits up to 150, 200 acres. It all depends on what the individual is trying to farm. If you look at spat for oysters and something that is basically confined to some type of penned area, that doesn't take up much state tidelands. But if you look at things like kelp, where you need a large area to produce a large volume of the product, then that's where you would look at hundreds of acres taken up in a lease.
Through the chair, thank you very much. I appreciate that, because I really didn't have any idea on the reasoning. Thank you.
Representative Hannon, and then we'll go to invited testimony.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Smith, you described and made sure that the bill is not impacting hatcheries, salmon finfish hatcheries, as opposed to shellfish hatcheries. But I am curious into the statute of the renewal and application process. Are they currently linked together? So are finfish hatcheries and shellfish hatcheries using the same process, and that lengthy renewal process? Because you described other uses of DNR land that use a shortened process, but yeah.
Representative Hannon, the chair. Salmon hatcheries are, there's a variety of mechanisms in the land that they utilize. I believe DIPAC is actually an agreement between the city and borough of Juneau, and the salmon hatcheries are run by nonprofits. So between that nonprofit and the city and borough of Juneau, I believe others are situated on private land, others are situated on
they're all on public land, but it's a question of, but really it's, do they fall under the statute currently in the same leasing process as shellfish hatcheries do, or are they, you, where's the piece where you said, the other ones that aren't following this process that are exempt from the extensive renewal? So I was trying to figure out, are they linked with those others in a shortened renewal process?
Representative Hannon, through the chair. My understanding is that when salmon hatcheries require a DNR lease, and if when that lease is renewed, it is typically done under 070, the general lease statute.
Okay, so only shellfish hatcheries have been held to this lengthier renewal process.
Representative Hannon, through the chair, shellfish and other aquatic organisms like kelp, but not salmon hatcheries.
Okay. Maybe I should quiz DNR on that.
And we have some invited testimony, too, that might be able to speak to this. So
thank you.
Any other questions? Mrs. Decker, are you online?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you great. Will you put your name on the and affiliation on the record and provide your testimony, please?
Sure. Thank you, Chairman Lincoln. My name is Julie Decker. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Fisheries Development Foundation. And today I would like to express support for this bill. Our organization, ASDF, has been spearheading an effort to develop the mariculture industry in Alaska through the Governor's Mariculture Task Force. We have completed a comprehensive plan, statewide plan, for developing the industry with a goal to grow a $100 million industry in 20 years. To one of the committee questions, that industry would be applicable in Southeast, South Central, Kodiak, and Southwest Alaska. We currently have farms in Kodiak, and my understanding is there have recently been at least one farm application in near Sand Point, Alaska. positive result of the Mariculture Task Force work has been an increased interest by private sector in aquatic farming. The recent interest has increased applications submitted to the state, which has led to a backlog and a longer processing time. The processing time has increased from approximately 12 months to about 24 months as the Department of Natural Resources works through the applications. I want to point out that the initial application process is very rigorous. ADNR consults with multiple agencies. They consider user conflicts, biological concerns, habitat concerns, protections for marine mammals, navigation hazards, public comment period, as well as others. If an application is approved and makes it through this process, the farm must, after only 10 years, go through a renewal process, which is what we're talking about, which is sort of a higher standard than other industries and other leases. So in an effort to efficiently develop this industry, this bill would make a good step in that direction. It would do several positive changes. It would reduce the workload at DNR for staff, which has increased due to the increased interest in applications submitted recently. Secondly, it would prioritize DNR staff time on the new farm lease applications, which would help grow the industry. And third, it would give more certainty to farmers who have invested in site infrastructure during the first 10 years of the lease. So I would like to recommend support this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you, Ms. Decker. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Rauscher?
Yeah, I, through the chair, we have a flow chart here, and this is the existing process. And do you have one for what you're addressing?
Through the chair, Mr. Rauscher, Representative Rauscher, the main process we're talking about in this flowchart is under the DNR. You go down the flowchart where it says aquatic farm lease. And I think one of the main points is people put up a lot of capital to start their farm, and it takes 3 to 7 years to even know and get to the spot if they're going to have a viable farm. And so having to renew and go through the whole process for the second renewal, which is, comes at 10 years, it would make it simpler since they've recently gone through this rigorous process. And then at the 20 years, then you do have to go through, you have no choice, you go through the whole original process again. But we're trying to make that second step smoother for everyone. And if anyone in Fish and Game would like to comment and expand on that, that's welcome.
Thank you.
Mr. Pryor, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here. This is Flip Pryor, Alaska Department of Fish and Game, for the record. I think that was an accurate description of what's going on with the flowchart.
I believe, did you hear Representative Rauscher's question about how the proposed change to renewals is would affect the flowchart? Are the steps involved with the proposed renewal process captured on the flowchart? Are we just eliminating some steps, or is it, how does it vary?
Oh, so I believe you just take the last line of the flowchart, and where it says you get approval, then you go to the bottom line. After the 10 years, you would just start over at that bottom line again.
At the DNR final decision line?
That's my understanding.
So is there an enact, how do you enact it? With an application? Do you enact it with an understanding that it's going to happen? I guess I'm wanting to know how you enact the process after. On the shorter period of time, obviously on the 20 years, you're going through the whole thing again, I guess, with an application process. But how is you enacting the short term?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, you will, for the 10 years, you go through the rigorous process, and then you still have to fill out an application and practically do a lot of the same steps. It's just that there is a shorter public process involved. There still is opportunity for public to weigh in, and there's regulatory oversight, and DNR would hear any appeal of it, but it is a shorter, what would I say, public process, review process.
All right. I think I'm starting to get it. Thank you.
Sure. Representative Hanning.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm going to ask Mr. Pryor the questions I was torturing Mr. Smith with, which is, could you describe for me the difference in the leasing process between a shellfish hatchery and a finfish hatchery? As it is currently for the leasing, and how it would be different under House Bill 116.
Okay, this is Flip Pryor, Alaska Department of Fish and Game, addressing the question through the chair. My understanding is this would bring this more online with how the FinFish leases would work, in that when it comes time to renew, rather than start at step A in the flow chart, you're going through the commissioner, and the commissioner can look at the renewal that's been put in front of them and make the decision there without going through that top, the top 5-6 steps.
Paul? So currently, FinFish farms are allowed to have this, the shortened renewal process, and it's only shellfish hatcheries and farms that have not been able to do that for DNR renewals. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. One more follow-up. FinFish farms, or excuse me, shellfish farms are limited to a 10-year lease. Is that just by practice, or is that by statute? And are FinFish hatcheries limited to that short a time?
Answering the question through the chair, I'm not sure if that's correct. I'm not sure how that works.
Could I ask it a different way? Do you know what the average length of hatchery leasing locations are currently for FinFish hatcheries?
I do not, no.
Representative Rauscher?
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. I don't know how to ask this question, and it's not really mine. It's coming from a letter that I've gotten. And basically what they're asking here is to leave the word renewal in as critical for relevant considerations in AS 38.05083. Now, basically it says do not remove the opportunity of relevant consideration upon renewal of an oyster farm. We're just beginning to understand all the repercussions this presents as farming of the navigable waters grow. I was hoping you can address those statements for me, because those are a concern that I have gotten, and I'd like to understand their concern and how it equates to where you're at with your bill.
Would you like to take that, Mr. Smith?
Yeah. Sure. Representative Rauscher, through the chair. In terms of the function of the bill, it's my understanding that we do need to remove the or renew terms found throughout 083, or else we will always be triggering this more extensive public comment period. One thing to remember is that the shortened renewal procedure process that is available for, again, many other types of DNR leases with arguably equal or also significant potential impacts on public lands, that is a optional choice for the director of mining, land, and water. My understanding from the department was if there was a lessee who was not following the stipulations of the lease, if there were significant problems with neighbors and the public, and there was a lot of clamor about a lease for any type of reason, the director does not have to choose to go through this shortened lease renewal process. They could go back out through essentially starting at the top of the flow chart again, case dependent. My understanding is also if there is issues with the lease upon renewal, they could make changes to that lease.
And follow up. So is that stated somewhere in your bill here that there's an option there for them to revert there if there is a problem?
My understanding, and this might be a good question. Through the chair, Representative Rauscher. My understanding is that optional choice is found in Section 1 of the bill on page 1, line 5, and that's the director may renew a lease issued under this section, and where we're adding the aquatic farm leasing. That may be a legislative legal may be able to help a little bit further on that, but that's my understanding of why that's a why this is a, it's not a shall, it's a may.
Follow up to probably those online, do they read their that to mean the same thing?
Mr. Bullard, are you available?
Members of the committee and chair, this is Alpheus Bullard of Ledge Legal, and yes, I am on the line.
Do you mind restating your question for Mr. Rauscher, or Representative Rauscher?
Basically, I believe it wasn't my statement through the chair. It was the statement. I'm going to ask the gentleman who made the statement to do the question again.
Greg Smith, staff to Representative Story. My understanding of the question is where is it stated in statute that this expedited lease renewal process is an optional decision?
And through the chair, he referred to Section 1. Where was that?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, Greg Smith, staff to Representative Story, Section 1 on page 1, line 5.
And through the chair, through the word may, gives them that power? Is that what you're saying? Okay, thank you. Is the question understood?
Members of the committee, if the question, forgive me, Representative Rauscher, through the chair, and members of the committee, if the question is what provides the director with the discretion to decide to renew a lease, Mr. Smith is correct. It's the word may on line 5 of page 1 of the bill.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate it, then.
And related to that, if you turn to page 2, lines 7 through 9, I don't know if this relates to the question, but it says the commissioner for good cause may deny an application for issuance, but you're deleting or renewal of a lease under this section, but shall provide the applicant. So it says you may deny an application for issuance of a lease, but not for renewal of a lease. Does that have any relevance to the conversation right now?
Through the chair, I think the questioning was input from the community, whether that was still up in there, and I believe he was addressing that if there seems to be a problem, that they would revert back to the process of asking the community. And that's my understanding of what we're talking about here. Is that correct?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, it is my understanding from DNR that there is that the public can weigh in during the initial lease and also at renewal.
Okay. Thank you.
At this point, it's 3:04. We have another committee scheduled for this room, and we have to have a hard end time of 3:10. So we'll hold public testimony until Monday, next time the bill will come before us. We do have another invited testifier that I'd like to give them an opportunity to speak. We still have 6 minutes, but Representative Tuck, do you have a question?
Yeah, just a quick one here. So basically, the initial process remained the same. And then we're going to renew. My concern is page 2, lines 7 through 10, that does it still stand that the commissioner, for good cause, may deny a renewal of a lease?
Excuse me, through the chair, Representative Tuck, could you say that again?
Yeah, please? On page 2, lines 7 through 10. Section 3 there. Right now we have the same initial process. So we on page 1 we take out renew or renew. Mm-hmm. That way, we're only looking at the initial process. But then we get into the commissioner's ability to deny an application. Is that only for issuances, or is that for issuance and renewal? Are we taking away the ability for the commissioner to deny a lease for renewal?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, we are taking out the renewal here, but in the statute that we referred to earlier, it still can be denied in the renewal process that we would be switching to, if they had any cause for that. And welcome for clarification on that from Fish and Game or anyone else online. There can always be a reason for denying the renewal. It would just be it's expedited.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, if we have someone online that can answer that question, if they can also answer the question, can a commissioner deny anybody even in the middle of their lease?
Mr. Bullard, did you hear the last two questions?
I did, Chair Lincoln. This is Alpheus Bullard of Ledge Legal. Through the chair, members of the committee, and Representative Tuck, in this case, it would be the director. It would have the latitude to deny a lease on renewal. If you go to 3805070, which is where the renewal process is moving, from 3805083, if the director determines that the lease is not in the best interest of the state, the director should not renew the lease.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
And the second question was whether that could happen in the middle of a lease term. At first blush, I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Pryor, are you able to contribute to this discussion specifically on whether a lease can be terminated mid-lease?
This is Flip Pryor, Alaska Department of Fish and Game, addressing the question through the chair. I can't answer that. I'm assuming they can, but I can't give you as that or a reg off the top of my head.
Okay, and would you or your group be the appropriate entity to provide the committee with that information, or who would be best suited to follow up with us on that?
Oh, I could definitely follow up.
Okay. We've got 2 minutes, and I think at this point we'll hold both public testimony and the second invited testifier until Monday, if they're hopefully available again at that time. Any other questions before we adjourn today? Okay. Representative Tallarico?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make a point. I've dealt with these leases before with municipal government as well as privately. And somewhere in our general terms of a lease, that if you violate the terms of the lease, that there's no doubt that you can forfeit all of the lease provisions. I think that's kind of a general rule for all of the leases we provide. If someone says, well, how do you cancel it in the middle? I think that's in statute, actually, and we've got provisions for that if terms of the lease aren't abided by. Just thought I'd make that. I'm not exactly sure where it is, but I know it's there.
Thank you, Representative Tully.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to visiting with you more on this bill Monday. Thank you for working with the committee today. And without any other business before the committee, we are adjourned at 3:09 p.m.